This is a broadcast I'm calling the propagation of anomalous sound, inexplicable sounds, and unexplained sources. Tonight, I'm going to present a survey of sounds with a bit of explanation. The sounds we will be listening to tonight are either of inexplicable origin, meaning we don't know what could create such a noise, or of unexplained purpose, where the source of the sound is known, but the reason for its existence is not. The first group of sounds that I will examine are underwater sounds captured by the Equatorial Pacific Ocean Autonomous Hydrophone Array, monitored by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, henceforth referred to as NOAA. The unidentified deep sea sounds captured by the NOAA Equatorial Pacific Ocean Autonomous Hydrophone Array are deep underwater benthic noises. The NOAA Hydrophone Array is part of the SOSIS sound surveillance system, a chain of underwater listening posts located throughout the world. SOSIS was initially established by the United States Navy as a tracking system for Soviet submarines and has since been rolled into what is known as the Integrated Undersea Surveillance System. As the system was unable to detect more modern and quieter submarines, it has been repurposed. Lockheed Martin was awarded a $153 million contract by the Space and Naval Warfare Systems Command to transform the Integrated Undersea Surveillance System to a civilian monitoring system. The IUSS is now known as the Equatorial Pacific Ocean Autonomous Hydrophone Array and is being used to analyze low-frequency spectrograms and distribution of pelagic marine mammals, monitor underwater volcanic activity, and observe the cause and effect of ambient ocean noise on marine ecosystems. The program has led to the identification of several anomalous, non-repeating sounds from the benthic reaches of the ocean. The source of these recordings is the NOAA Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory. Before we listen to them, there are some things I should mention about these recordings. The recordings are of ultra-low frequencies, so I will first play the sound sped up at a certain factor so that it is easier for you to hear and identify, and then I'll play the sound at its actual observed pitch. These sound waves are long-range and can have traveled thousands of miles before being observed by the hydrophone array. The noises are several times louder than any previously recorded biological sound. As you may expect, since these sounds were all captured by the Equatorial Pacific Ocean Autonomous Hydrophone Array, all noises here were recorded at benthic depths in the Southern Pacific Ocean. Most famous of the sounds that I'm going to play tonight from the NOAA array has been nicknamed the bloop. It was first noticed in the summer of 1997. After intense investigation, NOAA ruled out human activity, geologic activity, or vibrational underwater currents as the source of this sound. So first, we're going to hear the bloop at a factor of 16x. And here is the bloop at a factor of 1. Thank you. 2 years later, on March 1st, 1999, another sound was heard. It lasted only 15 seconds, and it was dubbed Julia, because apparently if you listen very closely, it sounds like a watery voice saying that name. The sound is unique in that it was picked up by every sensor in the Pacific Ocean, a hydrophone array. Its origin was 1,500 miles west of Peru, about 1,000 miles north of the location of the bloop recording. But scientists have no idea what made the noise. The one thing that they can all agree on, though, is that it was made by an animal, not a man-made device or seismic activity. We're going to listen to the Julia noise at 16x and then at a factor of 1. That was the Julia sound at a factor of 1, preceded by the Julia sound at a factor of 16 times its normal speed. The next sound that we're going to listen to is called the upsweep. This sound was present when PMEL, the Pacific Marine Environmental Laboratory, began recording in August 1991. It consists of a long train of narrowband upsweeping sounds of several seconds duration each. The source level is high enough to be recorded throughout the Pacific. It appears to be seasonal, generally reaching peaks in the spring and fall. But it is unclear if this change is due to changes in the source or seasonal changes in the propagation environment. The source is roughly located at a source of inferred volcanic seismic activity, but the origin of the sound remains unresolved. The overall source level has been declining since 1991, but the sounds are still heard and detected on the hydrophone array. We're going to listen to upsweep sound at 20 times its normal speed and then at its observed and detected pitch. that was the upsweep sound at its normal speed. The next sound that we're going to listen to is called the whistle. This was observed on July 7th of 1997. It lasts about 1 minute long, and I think that you'll understand why it's called the whistle. We're first going to listen to the whistle at a factor of 16 times faster than its observed pitch and speed, and then we're going to listen to simply an excerpt of the actual whistle recording, because it's very, very long. This is a very, very loud and very, very low sound. Sound referred to as the whistle there at its actual pitch and speed. The next sound that the NOAA array discovered is called slowdown. Slowdown is properly named. It's a mysterious sound. The original recording was 7 minutes long, and it, as you listen, you can hear it slowly decrease in frequency. Slowdown has been noted several times on the hydrophone array since making its debut in 1997. And because of that, it has many researchers thinking that its origin is more than likely geological, perhaps a shifting tectonic plate or moving icebergs against underwater land masses. But Again, no one is sure. So we're going to listen to slow down at a factor of 8 times its normal speed, and then we're going to listen to it at its actual recorded pitch. Was the sound known as the slowdown. The last sound that we are going to listen to this evening from the recordings of the NOAA Pacific Hydrophone Array is called The Train. And the train was observed first on March 5th, 1997. And it hasn't been heard since. The train is going to be played for you at its regular speed. So what are some explanations for these anomalous sounds? The bloop, Julia, slow down, the whistle, upsweep, and the train. Many scientists are sort of offended by these noises and the fact that they can't really discern or discover what they are. They've even invented a process called ice calving, which they want to consider as a possibility for causing the sound. Basically, you know, global warming is causing the melting of the polar ice caps and causing unprecedented noises underneath the sea. In my mind, the profile of these sounds suggests that it comes from a marine animal, and a lot of scientists seem to agree with that hypothesis. The largest known animal on Earth is the blue whale, but it would be physically impossible for a blue whale to emit sounds as loud as slow down or as far-ranging as the bloop. If a creature made this sound, it would have to be several times larger than any creature that we currently know about. The Pacific Ocean is the largest unexplored frontier in the world. it's very possible that there are whales larger than anything that we've ever seen, or that, you know, there's some other animal down there making these noises that has yet to be discovered. Or maybe it's Dagon or Cthulhu, or possibly sounds resulting from the melting of the polar ice caps or underwater earthquakes. No one knows. But the Equatorial Pacific Oceanic Autonomous Hydrophone Array is still recording, and thank goodness, because it cost at least $200 million. Now we're going to change gears and talk about mysterious radio transmissions, one of my favorite subjects. We're going to listen to recordings of three shortwave radio stations that broadcast from within Russia. Due to a similarity in broadcast format of these three shortwave stations, they are thought to be remnants of a larger military radio relay system, a control system whose purpose is as of yet unknown. Each station has a signature sound, which repeats, breaking only when the broadcast is interrupted by a spoken message or a repeated series of call letters. These stations are known as the Bubber, the Pip, and the Squeaky Wheel. The first station that we're going to talk about is UVB 76, aka the Buzzer. This station was first noticed in the early 80s. The signal varies between 31 to 24 buzzes per minute, and a double buzz every hour on the hour. It's a full carrier AM station broadcasting at 4625.0 kilohertz on the dial. And frequently, there is an interruption in the broadcast of the buzzer, and UVB 76 will fulfill the purpose of a number station, reciting short strings of numbers, words, letters, or names. Okay, that was the buzzer, and I think that you can understand how it got its name. So the buzzer broadcast in this way for, you know, almost 30 years, at which point there was what I would consider a breach in buzzer security. On August 25th, 2010, there was a broadcast that sort of gave lie to the station's clandestine nature. Let's listen to it, and then I will provide you with a translation. Okay, here it is. Sorry, that is not it. Here it is.
Дежурный по усилию Надежда, прапорщик Николаев. У нас пропал суд это за судаком, Надежда Судак. Вулкан он тоже пропал. Сейчас вулкан разбирается, в чем причина.
Еще раз, это Надежда, Судак,
да.
Вулкан, Судак.
Да, вулкан Судак, да. Там это между вулканом и судаком какая-то проблема.
Хорошо, мы с вами же вулкан. Я готова тренировку и потом оповестим, что вулкан.
Не понял. Ну да, я должен прийти в музон отзвониться. Они должны. Да, они же мои вышли на вас. Я за Витаков хотел вас уточнить. Вот Витаков только дежурный механик. Ему она дозвонила-то? Я понял.
Thank you.
сократить дежурство.
Вы просили...
Я просил оперативно дежурного, сказали, что он сидит вместе с дежурным по связи, что он занят. Я вас не понял. Сейчас за реальное время вы выбегаете контрольный звонок или как?
Еще раз не понял.
Вы контрольный звонок, вы сейчас объявляете?
Да.
Все понял, пожалуйста, вас не понял.
And there we hear the resumption of the buzzer. So clearly there was some sort of mistake made. Somebody sat on a button and took what was going on inside the station live. And here is a translation of what you just heard. So, duty officer of Sudak, duty officer of Nadezhda, warrant officer Nikolev. We have lost signal with Sudak. Nadezhda Sudak. Volkan also lost it. Right now, Volkan is trying to figure out the problem. Yes, Volkan Sudak. Somewhere between Volkan and Sudak is a problem. Okay. Yeah, I have to call all the folks. There is only one duty mechanic on duty. Do I have to call him? Okay, I got it. And he asks for the duty officer and gets a reply that he's busy right now. Then the woman's voice, Sudak, I'm listening. Sudak says, no one answered me, not the communications officer, nor the duty officer. See, he's already looking for someone to blame. Woman, did you ask for the communications officer? I asked for the duty officer, but I was told that he is with communication officer and is busy. Woman, okay, wait a minute. This is Nadezhda. I do not get it. Is this a real-time control call? Once again, I did not understand. Woman, are you going to do the control call right now? Sudak, yes. Woman, okay, I understand. And then what we have is just a back and forth of the different control calls. So for the next 2 weeks, the station was simply the buzzer, which if we want to refresh our memories. That played uninterrupted for almost 30 years. But after that August 25th transmission of the control calls and the technical difficulties at the station, the buzzes continued, frequently interrupted by excerpts from The Dance of the Little Swans from Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake. Then about 2 weeks from the point of the breach in transmission security on September 7th, the station was renamed. The new call sign, instead of VB76, was MDZB, and it was given over the air as Mikhail Dmitry Inya Boris. Then the following message was transmitted: 04979 DRENDOUT TERENERSKIY. And this is interesting because soon after, the physical location of the UVB-76 transmitter was moved. The original broadcast was thought to originate from Povarovo, which was a top secret military town outside of Moscow, meaning that the only people who were allowed in the town were military people involved in the project at hand, which is still, you know, as of yet, unpublished and unknown. This outpost was operated by the first communications hub of the General Staff of Army for the staff of the Moscow Military District. The Povarovo site was abandoned soon after the September 7th change of station call sign, and the station is now thought to be broadcasting from Pskov near the Estonian border. The move of the station coincided with the consolidation of the Moscow and Leningrad military districts, which merged to form a new command coalition, which was located out of St. Petersburg. All right, the next radio broadcast that we're going to listen to is called The Pip. Sorry. That was The Pip. The Pip broadcast on frequency 5448 kilohertz by day and 3756 kilohertz by night. It broadcast around 50 beeps per minute, 24 hours a day. The beeping signal is occasionally interrupted, like the buzzer, for voice messages in Russian. The Pip has been active since around 1986, and its transmitter is thought to be located in Rostov-on-Don in southern Russia. The voice messages on the PIP have two distinct formats. There are test messages that consist of 10 call signs, each consisting of four numbers or letters and a list of 40 alphanumeric characters, which is thought to be a code message, basically to set the cipher. Another type of message, which begins with 8S1SCH, which is thought to be the station's own call sign, and that is then followed by two digits, then three digits, then a code word in Russian, then four pairs of digits. For example, 8S1SCH73373YDYVANIE8456-2235, but of course, in Russian. Okay, the third of the Russian shortwave stations that we're going to listen to now is called The Squeak.
Thank you.
All right, that's the squeak or the squeaky wheel. Not much is known about the squeaky wheel. It's been broadcasting since the mid-80s, and it has its own Enigma call sign designation, which is S-32. What's the deal with these Russian shortwave stations? I mean, they are similar to number stations, except that these stations only rarely broadcast information, which has led people to think that their job in the overarching military system that they're clearly a part of is something like a dead man's switch. That this signal is basically not transmitting any particular information, except that everything is okay. And that perhaps if these signals were to stop broadcasting, something would happen. All right, we're going to have to sort of speed things up here. Bear with me. We are going to move into the world of over-the-horizon radio, or as some call it, beyond-the-horizon radio, the world of large radar arrays. This first clip is a little boring, and it just reeks of Cold War, but it really does provide a great background on over-the-horizon radar systems.
To provide the United States increased bomber attack warning time, AFSC's Electronic Systems Division is developing an over-the-horizon backscatter radar system, or OTHB. This limited sector coverage experimental radar system is under construction in Maine. Here it will operate in the most difficult OTHB environment to prove its capability. There is a transmit site and a receive site 90 miles away. The transmit site includes the transmit antenna array and the transmitter building. The antenna consists of four arrays, each with 12 dipole elements ranging from 24 to 60 feet in length. The overall antenna is half a mile long and as high as 100 feet. To increase the radar's range, a ground screen will be attached to the antenna back screen and cover 58 acres in front of the antenna. Behind the transmit antenna array is the transmitter building. The transmitter system generates 1 million watts of radio frequency power. Each transmitter module produces 100 kilowatts average power. Each has an output port connected to elements in the four antenna arrays. Each high voltage power supply provides power to three transmitter modules. Although the transmitters are normally under computer control, they can be turned on and the power set manually. Specially designed filters provide the high degree of broadband performance achieved with this radar. Amplitude and phase are controlled by filter adjustment. The high precision of the radar signal is a special feature of this transmitter. The receive and operation site at Columbia, Maine is dominated by the 50-foot high, 3,900-foot long receive antenna and its 76-acre ground screen. The array's 139 50-foot poles supporting the antenna elements and back screen were installed within a 1-inch tolerance. The receive operations building contains the equipment for processing and displaying radar information. A mini-computer at the transmit site and one at the receive site control radar surveillance scan, waveforms, and other parameters. These computers are interconnected for single-point control of the radar operation. In the tactical room, these terminals are used for radar control, target tracking, and other functions. Two terminals are used for manual inputs of flight data. One is a senior director display of summary information and unknown track reports, and one is used for radar control. The primary radar data and track monitoring displays have keyboards, function keys, and a trackball. The operator can select various manual and automatic functions and add, delete, or revise tracks generated by the automatic trackers. The transmitted radar signal is bounced off the ionosphere and step-scanned across the sector at ranges as great as 2,000 miles. Aircraft reflect the radar energy, bouncing it back to the ionosphere and down to the receive antenna in four narrow receive beams. These are processed for detection and tracking. The radar's range increases enemy bomber attack warning time from minutes to hours. Development of this experimental radar system is on schedule, and the decision to build an operational CONUS over the horizon radar system will be made in 1981.
Okay, I hope you got that all. Over the horizon radar systems, ICBM, Star Wars, lots and lots and lots of antennas, miles and miles and miles and miles of cables, big powerful waves, that kind of thing. All right, now it's time to talk about Duga 3, or as it is referred to in the Anglo world, the Russian woodpecker. This one really brings the tinfoil hats out of the woodwork. Here's a segment from CNN from the early 80s.
This is a Soviet LIDA machine. It transmits low energy radio pulses between 0 and 100 cycles per second. In the Soviet Union, LIDAs have been used for years to tranquilize psychiatric patients without physical contact. This sound, which is received by shortwave radios in the United States, is generated by another Soviet radio frequency device. It is known as the woodpecker because of its tapping noise. It is broadcast by a number of high-powered radio transmitters operating deep in the Soviet Union since July 4, 1976. Though the official Defense Department explanation of the woodpecker is that it is an over-the-horizon radar designed to track U.S. missile launches, some scientists suspect that the woodpecker is designed to interfere with human brain function.
As far as I'm concerned, the potential that this has for producing a direct psychoactive effect upon the total American population is there. Has never been disproven.
Dr. Robert Becker is a pioneer in the field of bioeffects of electromagnetism.
The signal range within which the woodpecker operates is that which has been reported by many investigators to produce a tranquilizing effect upon animals.
We are just incredibly sensitive to these magnetic stimuli.
Dr. Bob Beck, a PhD in nuclear engineering, has done extensive research into electromagnetic effects on humans.
The signal was permeating power grids in the United States. It was being picked up by power lines, re-radiated. It was coming into the homes on the light circuits.
I was surprised after coming here that the influence of electromagnetic fields was almost completely ignored here.
Dr. Larissa Volinskaya was heavily involved in Soviet electromagnetic research before being allowed to emigrate to the United States. She told CNN about Soviet research in electromagnetic effects.
They demonstrated theoretically and also demonstrated experimentally that low energy electromagnetic fields also can possess biological influence, biological efficiency, because any field not only carries energy but also carries information.
She stated that the research was carried out on orders from the Soviet government.
And of course, the military were extremely interested in this potential of remote influence.
Is the United States military working in the field of electronic mind control? Officially, the Department of Defense will not comment because the subject area is, quote, too sensitive. But CNN has learned from this government scientist, who did not want to be identified, that a Navy laboratory conducted research into the use of an RF device for counterterrorism and special operations.
It's possible to entrain a certain percentage of a population, apparently, with weak magnetic fields.
The study also showed that RF signals could dissolve certain types of rat brain cells at a distance, causing disorientation and nausea. According to the scientist, even though the program was successful, the government never followed up on it. Dr. James Frazier did electromagnetic research for the U.S. Air Force for many years. At one time, he proposed a battlefield RF weapon system.
You could make a an antenna that would be carryable by a helicopter, and that this could be expected to produce a wide variety of symptoms, actually, by humans who happen to be standing in the beam.
According to Dr. Fraser, the Air Force never followed up. At Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, another RF weapons concept is nicknamed the Brain Bomb. According to the book Star Warriors, the Brain Bomb would focus a nuclear blast into a huge pulse of low-frequency RF energy that would stun huge numbers of troops. Apparently, it too has not yet been funded. The Department of Defense will not comment about Soviet RF weapons, or if American RF weapons development is going forward. However, experts interviewed by CNN say that the Soviets are apparently ahead and could exploit that lead in a surprise strategic move, a move that could have grave consequences for the United States. From Washington, this...
Can you believe that the Brain Bomb didn't get funded? Okay. So... Duga 3, the Russian woodpecker. I'm running out of time here, so I'm just gonna lay it all on you. All right. The signal is broadcast continuously from 1976 to 1989 until the collapse of the Soviet Union. Signal disrupted regular and amateur radio, utility transmissions, and various communication systems all around the world. Other than being a nuisance factor, nobody could figure out the purpose of this strange radio transmission. There was a Dr. Milton Zaret, an ophthalmologist, who was warning about the effects of microwave radiation on the human eye. He was hired by the government, the United States government, to investigate what they called the Moscow signal. This. Because the U.S. Embassy in Moscow was being subjected to what they feared were microwave beams. Dr. Zaret's work promoted author and science writer Paul Broder to publish a book entitled The Zapping of America, 1977, which proposed that the Russian woodpecker transmission, which is what Duga 3 is colloquially referred to, was in some way harmful to humans. Ira Einhorn, in an article published in the 1977-78 edition of Coevolution Quarterly, in an article called A Disturbing Communique, took the issue one step further. He proposed that the radio waves were part of a sinister mind control experiment and that the Russians were attempting to brainwash non-communist countries. He also coined the word psychotronics in this article as the system being used by the Russians through this transmission. Einhorn wrote about the exact synchronicity between this shortwave pulse and naturally occurring alpha frequency brainwaves. That's 40 hertz. In the article, Einhorn advances the opinion that the Russians are engaged in a mind control experiment of truly Orwellian dimensions. Posing this question in the article was enough for this phenomenon to become associated with Einhorn, as Einhorn would soon be the subject of a high-profile murder investigation where he was ultimately convicted. It basically has served to discredit him during his trial, this idea that the radio signal is being used for mind control, and Einhorn's association with this idea also has discredited study into the possible physical and mental effects of this broadcast. Einhorn's theories were not ignored, however. They were supported by military intelligence officers. Lieutenant Colonel Thomas Bearden traced these signals from an installation at Riga and Gomel, both near Chernobyl. He said that he believed they were being produced by a Tesla generator and that the signals were responsible for weather modifications, a la HARP. He blamed the signals for a particularly bad drought worldwide that caused major effects on farm crops in 1976. Dr. Andrew Machowski, a technology specialist with the Canadian Department of State and president of the Planetary Association for Clean Energy, wrote in 1982 that the signal was from a number of Tesla-type transmitters and that the USSR signals have been assessed by the Environmental Protective Agency of Canada to be psychoactive. An interesting counterpoint to this, in 1984, a Dr. Ross Ady, who is the chief of research at the Pettus Memorial Veterans Hospital in Loma Linda, California, obtained from Soviet psychiatric colleagues what was known at the time as a mini woodpecker transmitter. is called the LIDA, and apparently it was developed by Lev Rabachev and other scientific colleagues in Soviet Armenia. The LIDA was a small box that operated on a frequency of 40 megahertz and bombarded the brain with low-frequency radio waves. The Russian used it experimentally as a replacement for tranquilizers. The pulsed radio waves were said to stimulate the brain's own electromagnetic current and produce a trance-like state. Adi had obtained a copy of a Russian language manual describing the use of this LIDA device, which said that it was, quote, a distance pulse treatment apparatus for psychological problems, including sleeplessness, hypertension, and neurotic disturbances. Increasingly, after the Associated Press reported on Adi's scoop, he concluded that the LIDA may have been the forerunner of a device that is presently bombarding Europe and the United States with very powerful waves. The LIDA was developed in the 60s. An interesting conclusion and a direct reference to the woodpecker pulse produced by the Duga 3 array. As the LIDA had not been approved for use with humans in the U.S., though it was known that the Russians had used it in such experiments since at least 1960, Dr. Adi decided that he would put a cat in a box and turn on the LIDA. And he said that within a minute or two, the cat stopped scratching and sat there very quietly and stayed there completely still, as if transfixed, until he turned the box off. Seems the LIDA could be a proof of concept or a small range test version of the technology that was originally used to produce the Duga 3 signal. In 1988, the Federal Communications Commission conducted a study on this signal. The data analysis showed an interpulse period of about 90 milliseconds, a frequency range of 7 to 19 megahertz, and a bandwidth of 0.02 to 0.8 megahertz. A typical transmission cycle of 7 minutes. The signal is observed using three rates more commonly than all others. That's 10 hertz, 16 hertz, and 20 hertz, with 10 hertz being the most common frequency observed. An interesting phenomenon, and I'm going to leave you with this tonight, in the conclusion of our symphony of anomalous sounds. Amateur radio operators found that the woodpecker signal would interfere with other broadcast signals across the frequency band, and because of the ridiculous strength of the signal. So this was upsetting to shortwave enthusiasts, and they would attempt to jam the woodpecker signal by transmitting synchronized, unmodulated, continuous sine wave functions at the same pulse rate as the offending signal. They formed a shortwave club, and they called it the Russian Woodpecker Hunting Club. And here is an example of recordings of some of their applied signal jamming.